AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, in just 7 days, I can make you a man. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Was that a reference to The Ring?
No.
No?
No, that was a lyric straight from Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Ah.
The Charles Atlas song, In Just 7 Days, I Can Make You a Man.
All right.
Well, it's because today we're going to talk about making life forms synthetically, artificially, not through the old biological way. Like, taking all the building blocks of pieces of life and cramming them together until you get some sort of glorious Frankenstein's monster of a creation that can rampage throughout the countryside and make the peasants all scared.
Or a single-celled organism.
Or, okay, well, we gotta crawl before we walk.
Yeah.
Well, okay. We've got a flagellum before we crawl.
That's right. That's also
a little
also
bit
fair.
Of paddling through some fluid.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about synthetic biology, which is a very interesting area of future research, present research, and especially future research, because synthetic biology comes up all over the place when you start talking about future solutions to problems. Like,
sure.
One great example is we've talked about, I know we've referenced it before in the idea of colonizing other planets. Like, how can we make all the materials we need and, you know, the food and the fuels and the medicines and stuff like that on the surface of Mars without having to carry just tons and tons of supplies and cargo along with us? And one of the solutions people have proposed is, well, what if we created organisms that we could take in tiny colony cultures with us that would multiply once we got to the planet and then make all of these things we need?
Right, taking the raw material that is available available on Mars and converting it into the stuff that we would find useful.
But of course, we'd have to take a step back first and say, wait a minute, can we create organisms like that?
And if we can, should we? We've got a lot of questions. But first, the first question we have to ask is, what is synthetic biology? Because it's such a relatively new discipline. There are actually multiple definitions for it, and it depends largely upon what perspective you're taking. It's clearly related to genetic engineering.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about manipulating the genes of an organism to create some sort of biological change, but it kind of goes a step beyond just that.
Uh-huh.
And creating a firm definition for it is tricky, but one way to look at it is take the principles behind engineering and apply them to biology. Now, there is a website, syntheticbiology.org, and they define it as the design and construction of new biological parts, devices, and systems, and the redesign of existing natural biological systems for useful purposes. And they also state that there are two different types of synthetic biologists. The first group uses, quote, unnatural molecules, end quote.
That's unnatural.
Yeah, unnatural molecules, meaning man-made, to mimic natural molecules with the goal of creating artificial life. This would be that Frankenstein's bacterium I was just talking about. The second group uses natural molecules and assembles them into a system that acts unnaturally. This would be closer to what you were talking about, Joe, finding some sort of or creating some sort of organism that can take something that we don't find useful and turn it into something we do find useful.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can think of synthetic biology as a spectrum. On one end, you have the modification of existing biology, and on the other end of it, you have the quest to create an entirely new life form from scratch. Whether it's a new, maybe not a totally new life form, but maybe a specific individual within a pre-existing species, but with a synthetically created genome.
Yeah, and so you might be wondering, well, what does this look like in reality? Well, we don't have to speculate.
Yeah.
Because, in fact, synthetic organisms already exist.
Yes.
Yeah, they have already been created.
They're around
they're
you
like
right now.
6 years
We've
old.
Done missed it.
Back in 2010.
Yeah.
So a little more. And, in fact, just about 6 years ago from this week was when the scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute. Why does he leave the J in there? Nobody says the J. The Craig Venter Institute. When they announced the creation of the first synthetic cell. Mm-hmm. And this was not the first time that synthetic DNA had been put together.
Right.
But this was the first time that there was an organism that began as pure information, so just a sequence of code inside a computer, which was then translated into a real live organism built out of organic chemicals and became a new living species that could survive on its own and reproduce.
And we're still here, so it didn't create like the zombie apocalypse or anything.
Yeah.
If it has, it's a very slow burn.
Yeah. Well, in reality, it probably would be, I think.
I mean, Walking Dead Season 2 was pretty slow.
We don't have to get into that right now.
Right.
The cool thing, Craig Venter himself gave a quote about this. Craig Venter, known, you know, big guy in genomics. You know him from the biotech field. Craig Venter said, quote, "This is the first self-replicating species we've had on this planet whose parent is a computer."
It's a fun, quippy way of putting it.
He's full of good quotes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it was a self-replicating synthetic bacterium. And the team that built it, they built it out of 1.08 million base pairs that went into a chromosome from the genome of a modified bacterium called Mycoplasma mycoides, or mycoides, M-Y-C-O-I-D-E-S, mycoides. It's a strange word.
It is.
I've heard people say it. They all say mycoides.
My ability to pronounce such words is so limited that I'm just going to accept whatever pronunciation you give us as the proper one.
Okay, well, there it is. And so Dr. Ham Smith, who was one of the leaders on the project, said, quote, "With the first synthetic bacterial cell and the new tools and technologies we developed to successfully complete this project, we now have the means to dissect the genetic instruction set of a bacterial cell to see and understand how it really works." So one of the things he's pointing out here is that it's not just about creating Frankenstein bacteria. It's about understanding the building blocks of life better.
Mm-hmm.
By building something, you understand what it is that makes that thing work.
Sure.
Right. Sure. Yeah. And you can see this like in engineering, again, showing the parallels to the engineering disciplines, that, you know, if you give someone a kit to build something, through the construction of that something, they get a better understanding of how it works once it's all put together.
Yeah, like a radio or whatever.
Yeah,
right.
And there's a really interesting thing I'm going to talk about in a moment where that idea comes into the very DNA of this new organism itself.
Mm.
The literal DNA, not the figurative DNA.
Exactly.
Yes.
So the creation of this viable synthetic cell was a project that took a long time, tons of research. It took almost 15 years. And to hear Venter explain it himself in his press release, he talked to the press about it, and he summed it up by saying there were two major challenges they mm-hmm. were dealing with. They'd already dealt with the sequencing the genome, so that was a hurdle they'd already overcome mm-hmm. going into this project. But the two remaining challenges, the first one was chemistry. How do you build this gigantic DNA molecule from its constituent parts? So it is a huge molecule. It's made out of lots of tiny little base pairs,
mm-hmm.
and it's just gigantic. And all of the base pairs have to be correct, you know, or not. A single error in some cases can cause the organism not to be viable.
Sure.
So you have to start with the genome of the bacterium in question. At first, what they were working with was Mycoplasma genitalium. They changed that later for a reason I'll let you know. But so they sequenced this genetic information, and then they had this digital information that spelled the recipe for the organism's DNA. But how do you turn that into a physical chromosome that goes into a cell? The second major challenge was essentially surgery. Once you've got a synthetic chromosome, how do you transplant it into a living cell and have that cell be viable and self-reproducing?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, they discovered that one host cell they were trying to transplant this foreign chromosome into was it was full of nuclease that was defensively destroying the foreign DNA when it was introduced. In Venter's words, it would just eat up our synthetic chromosome.
Also, I mean, good on that cell. Excellent.
Right, yeah. It was doing what it was supposed to
do. Doing
sure.
its job. Yeah, it doesn't want to be a synthetic organism.
No.
Right. It's like when you're being attacked by a virus.
Yeah.
So this is interesting. So the first challenge being, well, you're just creating the synthetic chromosome in the first place. And
yeah.
then once you have that, you still have the challenge of how do you introduce this into a living cell? Because otherwise you've just got data but no computer to run it on, essentially.
Yeah.
If you want to have a comparison to our technology. So you have to insert that software into a computer. In this case, it's a computer that already has its own software, and that software wants to kill the new software.
Yeah, it's got
antivirus. So it's Windows 10.
Yeah. once they got all that figured out, the way eventually they went about this was they built the synthetic DNA chromosome inside a yeast cell and then removed it from the yeast, and they had to methylate it because they discovered that methylation protects the DNA from being digested by the host bacterium, and then transplant it into a shell bacterium or a host bacterial cell. In this case, it was Mycoplasma capricolum. So another problem they encountered along the way, they talked about, was that the cell wouldn't grow fast enough. They were trying to do this, and so they ended up starting with the genome of a different organism. After Mycoplasma genitalium didn't work well enough, they went with Mycoplasma mycoides.
Mm-hmm.
And this organism had a much larger chromosome. It's bigger, harder to work with, at over 1 million base pairs.
Mm.
Another thing that's really cool that they did is they put watermarks in the DNA to leave no room for doubt as to whether the DNA was synthetic or natural. And what these were stretches of non-coding DNA, which is DNA that doesn't actually make any proteins. You could just think of it as kind of metadata or the, you know, / note sections in a piece of computer code.
Uh-huh.
And these were used to code in written messages in the organism's DNA, including names of the authors on the research, a web address associated with the project. So Venter said, you know, if you can decode this, you can email us.
and that's not all.
Yeah. Three quotes. They put some quotes in there. So one was a James Joyce quote. This is great. To live, to err, to fall, to triumph, and to recreate life out of life. Good selection
good
there.
Quote. Yeah.
A second one was from the book American Prometheus, which was about Robert Oppenheimer. And the quote was, "See things not as they are, but as they might be."
Mm-hmm.
That's a good one, too.
Not a bad Oppenheimer quote. I can think of one that would have been worse.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I am become death, destroyer of worlds.
And the third?
The third was, of course, from Richard Feynman, when Feynman said, "What I cannot build, I cannot understand." And that's the quote that I was referring to earlier.
Right. I'm very sad that they didn't include the Frankenstein quote, "Fire bad." I think that would have been
maybe,
a good one to add
in
there.
But maybe if we decode that email address,
right,
when we can write in some suggestions.
When I make my synthetic bacterium, that's definitely going in there.
You know, listening to Venter explain all of the different problems they encountered and fixes that they had to go through to finally arrive at this research success, it is amazing that they were able to do this. I want to read one particular paragraph from Venter's presentation from May 2010 about this, because I found this part really fascinating. It was about how the team had to develop debugging software to debug the organism, because, you know, they were creating a synthetic chromosome. Right? So here's how it goes. "So the team developed new debugging software where we could test each synthetic fragment to see if it would grow in a background of wild-type DNA. And we found that 10 out of the 11 100,000 base pair pieces we synthesized were completely accurate and compatible with a life-forming sequence. We narrowed it down to one fragment. We sequenced it and found just one base pair had been deleted in an essential gene. So accuracy is essential. There are parts of the genome where it cannot tolerate even a single error, and then there's parts of the genome where we can put in large blocks of DNA, as we did with the watermarks, and it can tolerate all kinds of errors. So it took about 3 months to find that error and repair it. And then one early morning at 6 a.m., we got a text from Dan saying, 'Now the first blue colonies existed.'" And that's referring to, you know, that these things were reproducing within a couple of days. I think there were enough of them that you could physically see them in the petri dish.
Oh, wow.
Wow, that is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I love this, that they had to create a debugging program for the organism.
Yeah, you imagine, like, that's a whole new discipline of quality assurance.
Right.
You know, having to go through and, because I, you know, we know people who do QA for a living. They have to go through and test every single element of code. This is, in fact, biological code. It is exactly it's in line with, I won't say it's exactly the same thing, but it's in line with that same sort of discipline.
Yeah.
It's also absolutely what they had in Jurassic Park.
Yes. Yeah.
Using virtual reality.
And Mr. DNA.
So another thing that I just wanted to emphasize, I know I've already said it, but I just find so fascinating about this and what it illuminates about the nature of life is how resilient the DNA code is in some ways and how fragile it is in other ways.
Right.
A missing or deleted base pair in one section of the code can completely make you a non-viable organism. But other parts you can just do all kinds of crazy stuff with.
Well, again, I think if you compare that to the idea of software, like there are errors you can make when you're coding something in software, and it might make something unusual happen when you're trying to execute the software. But there are other errors you could make that can make that software completely unstable, and it won't even run properly.
Not only crash, but crash your entire system.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking about every video game that's been released over the last 12 months, but maybe that's just because I'm a little bitter about game-destroying bugs released on day one.
Oh, I don't really know which ones you're referring to.
All of them, pretty much. Yeah. Anyway,
well,
but I'm saying the similarity really is there. I mean, as much as I'm making fun of something that's running rampant through the video game industry, the idea being that when you start to think about DNA being similar to software, at least in a general sense, then you're like, oh yeah, I get it, because some errors in coding are not that huge a deal. You might be able to pick up on it if something unusual happens while you're executing the code.
Yeah.
And others are absolutely deal breakers.
Yeah. But anyway, I think this is so cool that you can chart how they went from information to chemistry to biology.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was the entire pathway from idea to life. And so this first synthetic cell was called Mycoplasma mycoides JCVI for J. Craig Venter Institute, SYN 1.0, not SYN like doing evil,
S-Y-N. S-Y-N, like synthetic.
Synthetic, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So, Sin 1.0, what does it mean? Well, it helps us understand better the chemical basis of life. That's one big thing where we, you know, learn a lot about chromosomes and DNA and the role different genes play. And we can do continuing research now that we have the basis for creating synthetic organisms. It might be useful in synthesizing germs that cause diseases so those diseases can be treated and overcome. It might be useful for creating synthetic biological organisms like we were talking about earlier. So, you know, if you want to make some algae that could remediate waste products or capture CO2 or create biofuels or food or whatever.
Yeah, so these are you know, basic ideas. We'll revisit that toward the end of the episode too when we start talking about the various things you can do with the discipline of synthetic biology. This is a pretty important part of that.
Oh, yeah, an amazing first step.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that's not where the story ends. That was 2010,
but
we have continued the advancement of synthetic biology since then.
Yeah, an inventor and his team specifically have. After they created Sin 1.0, they set out with a new goal, to design a bacterium with the absolute minimum genome. And why would you want to do that? Well, they wanted to figure out what bits of code are essential and what are non-essential.
Yeah, and this is really smart to do, I think, because we had this problem last time, right, where some parts of code, it seems like, it don't matter. You can change them with no big impact. Other parts are game breakers.
Well, sure. And we've also found that there are segments of DNA within different organisms that ultimately originated from other species and don't have any useful performance. They don't do anything within the genome.
Or it's a duplicate of something else that already works perfectly fine.
Right. Yeah. So maybe we can make life better, more efficient, cut out the fat.
And furthermore, yeah, just what you were talking about, Joe, just figure out exactly what the different pieces do.
Yeah.
Because even though we've sequenced plenty of genomes, we really don't understand very well what all of the individual genes do and specifically how they work together in a genome.
Yeah.
That's way beyond us right now.
But this can help us learn.
Hypothetically. I mean, their first attempts totally failed. and no one was more surprised than Venter. There's a great quote where he was like, I was shocked. Like, oh,
well, you know what?
I love you.
I love the idea. We got to remember, you learn more through failure than you do through success.
Completely. That is literally how science works.
Yep.
Ideally, you can learn from other people's failures and your own successes.
Yeah, that way you look like you are awesome.
Right, much preferable. This first attempt that they made, two different teams, each independently, tried to build a bacterium from the ground up. And it was too ambitious, given our current aforementioned lack of knowledge about genetics and genomics. So to give you like a metaphor here, additive manufacturing a genome didn't work.
Gotcha.
But what about whittling something down? What about removing all the parts of the genome that are not the Statue of David?
Gotcha. All right. So the traditional subtractive approach,
right,
where you are taking away everything that is not necessary for whatever the finished product needs to be.
Yeah. So they took Sin 1.0 and they started labeling all of its pieces. They took its 901 genes and played with deleting or disrupting different sections in turn. And when they plugged the resulting experiments into a M. capricolum, it'd either be viable or totally not viable.
Uh-huh.
And if it died, if it was not viable, they knew that they'd removed something important.
Yeah. Okay.
Science.
This makes me think of what early medicine must have been like.
Yeah.
Turns out he needed that one.
It reminds me of that moment where Bones is, in the 20th century, and he's like, these savages!
They're in the Dark Ages.
But eventually it produced what they call Sin 2.0, which was the first microbe with a genome smaller than the world's smallest known natural genome, which is Mycoplasma genitalium, which has only 525 genes.
Yeah.
And then along came Sin 3.0, which is a living, reproducing organism with just 473 genes. They trimmed out all of those non-essential, or a lot of those non-essential and duplicate genes. But even at this point, the critter still might contain some coding bloat. The researchers are not sure what 149 of those genes do.
I do like the idea that they can cut out a whole bunch of genes and pass the savings on to you. I think that's very forward thinking, honestly.
Other than those amazing savings, why would you want to do this? Well, this resulting organism, SYN 3.0, can be used to study what specific genes do, both the ones that it currently possesses and also all of the bits that they removed from versions 1 and 2 in order to make 3. Mm-hmm. By adding them back in one at a time, they can watch the results play out. And furthermore, the SYN 3.0 grows like and reproduces really fast. So SYN 3.0 cell populations double in about 3 hours.
Wow.
So that's a great laboratory tool. And mm-hmm. and eventually they're hoping to create a living organism for which the entire genome is understood. And I cannot stress how rad that would be. I mean, even if you're only talking about the world's very bittiest genomic code, because, you know, like I said, like just because we can sequence a whole genome, even very much more complex genomes, humans, for example, have some 20 to 25,000 genes. That absolutely doesn't mean that we know what all of that coding does.
Right.
Right.
So it'd be a really huge mile marker.
And I think what's really cool here also is by adding in those genes one at a time and seeing what they do, it's not even as simple as that because genes can interact with one another. So sometimes it may be that you, let's say that you've got one version of this artificial life form and you add in one gene and you see how that works. You've got a different version of that same artificial life form that has a slightly different series of genes in it. It may not have exactly the same as the first one. You add that same gene into that one and you see that it expresses itself in a different way. That tells you there's going to be some sort of interaction going on. It also displays, there's so much we don't know. And it's, once you start looking at these numbers, like even just with a few hundred, it's complicated.
Oh, sure.
When you get to several, you know, tens of thousands, it gets really, really tough. So let's take a look at maybe something that might be a touch more ambitious, creating the first artificial human cell.
What?
Yeah. So in May 2016, we are recording this at the end of May 2016, about 150 genetics experts met at Harvard to talk about the possibility of building an entire human genome. Not altering one, not sequencing one, but building one. And the project is called HGP Write. WRITE, testing large synthetic genomes in cells, and HGP stands for the Human Genome Project. So this approach would require you to have access to a DNA synthesizer, a computer, and the raw materials, a cop car, some sunglasses.
What?
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm thinking about the Blues Brothers. DNA synthesizer, a computer, and raw materials were what you would need. Basically, they would build the entire genome from the ground up. And the next step would be to insert that synthetic genome into a human cell, kind of like what you were talking about, Joe, just to see if it could replace the already existing DNA within the human cell, boot that out of the way, and kind of reboot the cell so that it now is the synthetic one. So it's talking about really programming a new type of human cell. You program a human in the sense that you're the one who determines the DNA sequence from beginning to end. And Dr. Jay Kiesling of the University of California, Berkeley, is part of a group putting together a standardized a database of standardized DNA chunks, and they're calling these chunks biobricks.
Oh.
This is actually an idea that I think dates back to about 2006, but these biobricks represent specific stretches of genetic material, and assembling a full genome involves putting these chunks together, kind of like a big puzzle.
Like a Lego, but
yeah,
squishy human person at the end.
I think Lego is even better than puzzle. Definitely, yeah, it is like you've got the Lego blocks and your bio bricks. Like, oh, well, here's one that is this particular gene, and then we need to have this other one, this other connective piece here before we put this other gene in. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it's not all going to fall apart.
But definitely don't spill them on the floor because those hurt like a mother. When
step on a bio brick and it's going to be squishy and it's going to go right into the heel. So they're meant to be interchangeable parts, and you could build biological systems living within a cell, and you can arrange them to make quote unquote useful devices, which is, I thought, a really interesting way of putting it. Like, you can use biobricks to create useful devices. You're really talking about biological elements, and it's weird to think of a biological element as a device. But it does show, again, how engineering and biology are very commingled in this approach.
And, I mean, technically, like, our hands are devices, I guess.
I guess. I very rarely think of anything that is part of me as a device. And, I mean, I realize I'm almost physically attached to my phone all the time, but I still don't think of it as part of me. I don't pick it up and say, at last, my arm is complete again. But then you have a group called BioBricks Foundation, and that bills itself as, quote, a biotechnology in the public interest. And the purpose of this organization is to develop the tools and processes of synthetic biology in a responsible manner. So it's supposed to be concerned with ethics, with the cost of this, with the access of it so that people can learn from the research that they do and thus apply it to their own research. And they also want to make sure that they limit the spread of mad scientists, you know, keep that to a bare minimum.
That's nice.
Or at the very least, of short-sighted projects that might have bigger ethical problems down the line that you might not have anticipated just because you were focused on the first stage and not thinking, oh, what are the implications of this? One of the founders of the BioBricks Foundation is Dr. Drew Indy, E-N-D-Y, who played a role in developing the BioBrick standard part technology. So the Legos, in other words, he played a role in developing those. And interestingly, he actually declined to participate in that project I was talking about with the 150 researchers at Harvard. He said he wasn't going to go because he was concerned that perhaps they were rushing ahead toward a goal without really contemplating the ethical consequences of that.
Like maybe start with a goldfish first, you guys. Like do we really need to move straight to human?
And you know, we've talked about this on previous episodes where if you set yourself a specific goal, it hones you in, it focuses you so that you can really take the steps necessary to solve some big problems that ultimately can end up benefiting you in other ways and other applications. But it helps to have that goal there, to have something to work toward. But he still felt that perhaps this was a little too grandiose an idea with too few actual thought given, or too little thought given to the ethical implications. Now, when can we expect this to happen, assuming it goes forward? We don't know. They're talking about a 10-year time frame, but that seems incredibly ambitious. Mm-hmm. For one thing, this project's not funded yet. And for another, it's really difficult to say how hard it would be to actually synthesize a full human genome, and because that genome's 5,000 times larger than that bacterium we talked about earlier, the SYN 1.0. It's going to be expensive, though less so than it would have been a decade ago. In 2003, it cost $4 to sequence an individual letter in the genome. Now it's closer to 3 cents. So the money, the cost side of it is falling dramatically. But still, if you want to sequence the human genome, that's a 3 billion letters total, so that costs about $90 million. Hmm. That's a lot of money. If we continue to drive down the cost, then obviously genome synthesis could get closer to a more affordable amount. One estimation is that in 20 years, it could get down to about $100,000, which could be something that a major scientific research project could actually do. But that's 20 years, and that's 10 years beyond what the 10-year span of the project was proposed to be. So I don't know if this is actually going to go anywhere. It may end up being that people like Dr. Indy are able to say, hey, let's, before we jump into this project, let's have a deeper conversation about the implications of this and make sure we truly understand what we are doing, and that if we choose to go forward, we do so in a responsible manner.
Right, because the potential upsides of this are really incredible.
Yes.
I mean, I think the sky level hope for any kind of genetic study is that we will be able to design bits of code to replace genetic code that's causing deadly, terrible, incurable diseases and suffering in people. or to make our food sources grow better, faster, stronger, and more nutritious, and maybe vegan and in difficult conditions and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know, to make house cats that do care about us at all.
Wow.
Or
that's a tall order.
Giraffes with built-in rollerblades. I don't know what people get up to, but
yeah, I mean, you know, everyone's got a hobby.
Sure.
So yeah, I agree. I think that is definitely the ideal goal of this. You know, it's not to welcome. This is human version 2.0. We've built a
new
person.
You have crab claws now.
Right. That's not what people are going for necessarily.
Why is it always crab claws and clamps with you, Joe?
Yeah, they're the best.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't really learn anything about Joe. We just had something kind of reinforced, a belief that we had already discovered earlier.
I mean, hey, hold on. Do you guys go out of your way to mess with a crab? No, you don't.
Very true.
No.
That's accurate.
I mean, if there's a crab in my way, I'll go ahead and mess with it. But I don't go out of my way to mess with a crab.
I really only mess with them when I'm trying to consume their delicious flesh.
I mostly toss them aside now.
Just
out of fear.
Oh, no.
All right. At any rate, so that's the big picture. Like, if we can figure it out, maybe we can defeat lots of genetically or lots of diseases that are genetically based,
sure,
conditions or things like that. Perhaps extending lifespans, things of like that nature. That's like the gold standard a goal that we have. But there are other ones as well, right?
Yeah, and most of it is kind of along the lines of what Joe, you were talking about earlier. And what we have talked about previously on this show about genetically engineering bacteria to produce useful stuff like biofuel or bacteria that eat explosives and can thus be used to dismantle landmines. By building an entire genome, we can hypothetically make very, very efficient bacteria that do those sorts of things. And for example, Dr. Kiesling of the BioBrick project worked on this one proof of concept project in the early aughts in which a team created E. coli bacteria that produce an anti-malaria drug. And the yield from these bacteria is so much more efficient than from the traditional method of growing and harvesting sweet wormwood, which is how you usually get the drug component. It's like a million times more efficient than doing that. So the price of the drug dropped. Everybody wins.
That's super awesome. Yeah, and I was reading that synthetic biology has already led to the development of diagnostic tools for lots of different diseases, including things like hepatitis and HIV. So there are a lot of different potential applications for synthetic biology in the medical field. Not a big surprise. I mean, it makes sense that would be a place where we would really focus that. But there's the possibility that synthetic biology will play a role in lots of other different things. Like, for example, biologically based computational systems. I mean, there's the possibility for that too. I mean, we could biologically engineer an organic computer, and that is so science fiction that it makes my head spin a little bit.
Yeah, and there's research teams out there that are working on coding data in DNA.
So yeah, exactly.
And along those lines, you've also, of course, got the thing that we always like talking about on this show, which is the pure research angle.
You know, sure.
These lines of inquiry will help us figure out what genes do and how they interact with each other. And that is so worthwhile.
Right. I think to the general public, it's news that we don't understand all of this yet. Because
I thought we sequenced the human genome.
Exactly. Right. Once we got to the point of the sequencing of the human genome, everyone said, oh, so we now know what everything does, and you have to explain. No, what we found was the complete text of what we are, but we don't understand the language it's written in yet, not fully. And we don't know how this passage 14 chapters down actually depends heavily on something that's written in chapter 2 and something else that's written in chapter 37. Like, that makes it super hard for you to be able to interpret that.
So figuring that out, it would be nifty.
Yes,
I agree. To do that.
But, I agree.
Okay, so we've covered the wonder and the potentials of the future. Guys, let's get into some doom and gloom.
Okay.
What could go wrong?
Well, you know, this is what Dr. Endy was concerned about, right? The idea of let's think about the consequences of research to make sure that we're doing any sort of research in the most responsible way possible. So one possibility, although it's definitely in the realm of like more of the Stephen King horror story approach, is that someone develops a synthetic life form that ends up not being contained within a lab, and that ends up encountering the world at large and perhaps starts to replicate itself. This could be on the you know, single cell level. It doesn't necessarily have to be Frankenstein's monster like I keep joking about.
Or a zombie apocalypse. But it could certainly disrupt an ecosystem.
Right.
Right, yeah. So if, for example, it doesn't even have to be like a pathogen that attacks humans
right.
or something.
Right, it could be invasive.
Yeah, it could just be a very, very successful organism that outcompetes everything that naturally lives around it.
Right, and then we end up seeing decrease in biodiversity. We see various species end up fighting so that they don't go extinct. It ends up creating big issues. So there's that one. And, you know, if it were to turn into a pathogen, that would obviously be even worse. But it doesn't have to for it to have negative consequences in our world. There's also the question, going beyond like that approach, who owns the life form? This is a whole new area of science, and does it mean that you would be able to protect an engineered life form, like using intellectual property approach, like you would software? Would you copyright a life form? You're not supposed to be able to do that right now, but maybe the rules need to change if we're talking about a purely synthetic creature designed from the ground up.
So somebody, if they find this organism dwelling on your skin or in your hair or something like that, they can file a DMCA claim against you.
Yeah.
Right. Or you could end up suing the company that made the thing and say, you have not been very careful with your containment procedures because I've got it on me now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a weird thing to think about.
Fortunately, you put all these copyright clauses into its DNA, so I know where it came from.
Right. Look, you signed the service agreement as soon as that bacterium made contact with your skin. We're joking about it, but it really is a question of who owns that. Like, does the person who made the technology own it? Does the person who actually sequenced the or created, synthesized rather, the genes in that sequence, do they own it? Is ownership not even a thing? We don't have the answers to that. And then, of course, there are just the big ethical concerns. Is it all right? Is it ethical to design a life form, just any life form, let alone a human? And if it is, then is there a line? Like, is there a point where we say, before this, it's totally cool, but after this, we have to start asking ourselves some questions.
Yeah. How many cells does an organism have to have before we start to be worried about it?
Right. Is it all right to engineer bacteria so that we can do lots of medical research and potentially cure diseases? I think most people would say, yeah, that sounds like that would be all right. Or, all right, is it okay to genetically design, assuming we ever got this capability, which is a big assumption, but it was okay to genetically design an animal so that it most closely resembles a pet that you used to have.
Ooh.
Is that okay? Is it okay to design a human being so that the human being has as many positive attributes and as few negative attributes according to some given person's...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
according to the designer.
Is Gattaca okay is what I'm getting at. Is Gattaca okay? Not Galaga, which is awesome. But Gattaca. These are big questions. And again, that's the sort of stuff that Dr. Indy was asking. He was saying, you know, we need to consider this. Maybe we need to ask the should we question before we ask the could we question. That's, you know, Patton Oswalt's like, always asking the coulda, never asking the shoulda. He's saying we should ask the shoulda. Let's do that, guys. And I can't disagree with that. I think that's the responsible thing to do. But then I'm a liberal arts major, not a super scientist like the folks over at that Harvard meeting were. So really interesting. Do you guys have any other thoughts about synthetic biology before we sign off? It's okay to say no.
I think you've spoken all my thoughts for me.
That's fair. It's also really hot in here.
Yeah, at this juncture, I have thoughts about snacks.
Yeah, I have thoughts about air conditioning. Let's wrap this up. So, guys, if you have suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, you want to know how something's going to what it's going to be like in the future, or you've got comments or thoughts about any of the episodes we've done in the past, maybe you want us to do an update to an old episode where we've got more information now that we're further into the future than we were when we started, let us know. Send us a message. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can always drop us a line on Twitter, where we are FW Thinking, or search FW Thinking at Facebook. Our profile will pop right up. You can leave us a message there, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Hey, it's Bobby Bones. Are you looking to build this year? If so, there is no better time than right now to start planning and to get your spot on the construction schedule. If you need a garage, a stall barn, a storage for vehicles, RV, boat, collectibles, or even a shop for your farm, hobbies, or car restoration projects, visit mortonbuildings.com and start your construction process. With superior materials, craftsmanship, best-in-class warranty, Morton buildings are made to last for generations. At Morton, the difference is in the details. From their cutting-edge innovations to their craftsmen in the field, they are dedicated to surpassing expectations. Their legacy of excellence spans more than 120 years, and Morton Buildings is 100% employee-owned with more than 250,000 satisfied customers. That means they're the industry leader you can trust. When you choose Morton, you'll experience quality at every step of the building process, starting before the walls even go up. Visit mortonbuildings.com to get started today.